Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. Host John Krull will return to the show later this week. On today's show, we'll dig into the issue that's grabbed national headlines and consumed Indiana politics, the state's new religious freedom law. Our guests are David Orentlicker, a former Democratic Indiana legislator and professor of constitutional law at Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. We'll also be joined by Bob Schultz, director of marketing and communication at Downtown Indy, and Tom Lobianco, a political reporter at the Indy Star and formerly of the Associated Press. And we'll take your calls and questions. But first, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
You're listening to No Limits on WFYI, and I'm John Ketzenberger. I'm in today for John Krull. I'm happy to have a panel of guests today to talk about House Enrolled Act 101, which is commonly known as RFRA, or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that was signed by Governor Pence last Thursday. Joining me today is David Orentlicker, and David is the Samuel R. Rosen Professor and Co-Director of the Center for Law and Health at IU's McKinney School of Law. He's the adjunct professor of medicine at the IU School of Medicine as well. Later in the conversation, we'll be joined by Bob Schultz, who is Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications at Downtown Indy. And we'll then be joined by Tom Lobianco, who is a political analyst for the Indianapolis Star. I want to begin with David because I've got in front of me two letters. One is by a group of 16 professors of law who are in favor of what is the RFRA bill. And then I have another one that is signed by 30 professors who think that the law is not a good law. And so I was going to read from both of these, but I think I'll spare the audience those long passages, because these letters are very long and they're very detailed and annotated. David, you've been in these positions for a long time. You are not a signatory to any of these. I am curious what you think about a law that is very unclear for the public, because it's, you know, so many people see both sides of the issue. Can you help us out with that?
Sure. Thank you for having me. Yeah, this is one of those public issues where the appearance of disagreement is much greater than in actuality. There is a broad consensus that these kinds of laws are a good idea, that we do need to protect religious freedom. There's clearly disagreement about particular provisions of the Indiana law. As you said, one group of professors thinks it has gone too far. They do agree, though, that there should be some protection. And this goes back, 50 years, if you include both constitutional decisions and federal legislation. It goes back to the early 1960s. And the idea here is the legislature passes a law that applies to everybody, but it burdens people who have religious beliefs. So some of the early cases were if you were fired from your job because you wouldn't work on your Sabbath, you observed your Sabbath on Saturday rather than Sunday, you lost your job. And then you said, well, I should get unemployment compensation. And, well, you were fired with cause because you wouldn't work when you were supposed to work. And the Supreme Court said, if you interfere with persons' religious practices, we're going to give you protection. That started in the 1960s. The old order Amish used it for so the kids didn't have to go through high school for education. They could leave after maybe the eighth grade, and they could get an exemption. So you could get an exemption from what we call generally applicable laws. Then the Supreme Court changed course and said, no, if that law isn't targeting your religious belief, they It's a law that everybody has to follow. You don't get an exemption because of your religious belief. And that led to all these religious freedom restoration acts, starting with the federal government and then a number of states that said, we want to restore what the Supreme Court said between 1963 and 1990, that you might be, it's not automatic, but the government has to have a good reason for not giving you an exemption. So that if you have the Sabbath observance, they should accommodate your Sabbath observance. If you're an Old Order Amish and you don't like the orange fluorescent triangles as a traffic safety regulation, then the government should let you use lanterns or other ways to make sure your traffic safety is served without interfering with your religious beliefs. Everybody, I think there's a broad consensus that this kind of thing is a good idea. People's religious beliefs should be protected. What has changed, I think what really changed this was the Hobby Lobby decision, because the classic case was the Old Order Amish or just recently in the past couple of weeks, a Muslim prisoner who wants to have a beard and the government won't let him, Arkansas government won't let him have a beard. And the Supreme Court says, no, you got to accommodate his beard. It's not going to interfere with prison safety. That's the classic case. What has changed with Hobby Lobby is now we're getting conflicts between different individuals or businesses and individuals. It's not government versus telling me what to do. It's my employer or a business that I'm trying to buy goods from as a consumer. That's what's changed. And I think when the Hobby Lobby court said corporations can invoke their religious scruples to avoid complying with government with rules. And then people worry, what about the burden on their employees or the customer who wants a wedding cake or photography? That's what's changed. And that's what the Indiana law does explicitly say what the Supreme Court said in Hobby Lobby, which is big corporations, you don't have to be an individual if you're an organization, a for-profit, not-for-profit, you can invoke our Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's bothered people for sure.
Well, so that begs the question, David, is the law that was passed in Indiana the same as the laws that was passed in 1993 by the federal government and the laws that have come since in other states?
Well, it has the one okay, so there are three differences.
Okay.
It's not exact. As a practical matter, I'm not sure that the differences are as big as people are saying. But one is the federal law didn't say corporations. The Supreme Court said that's what it means. So the Indiana legislature said explicitly what the Supreme Court has interpreted for the federal law. So even though the text is different, it doesn't matter practically because of the Hobby Lobby decision. The second difference is under the federal law, your practice has to be burdened. Under the Indiana law, likely to be burdened. So it makes it a little easier. I think that's, again, a minor difference. The third difference is that there is some uncertainty whether you can assert this if it's just a disagreement between individuals. I won't serve you. You sue me. The government is not a party to it. Can you invoke it? There's some ambiguity in the language of the federal RFRA. The federal courts of appeal disagree. Some say the government doesn't have to be a party. Some say it does. How would the government be a party? Let's say I go in. They don't serve me. I complain, and the government agency that enforces these acts sues the business owner. But again, I don't think in the big picture it's a big deal, but it's clear in the Indiana statute the government doesn't have to be a party. There's a disagreement on how the federal statute's interpreted.
Why do you think we've had such a broad and deep response to this law from people who primarily think it is a license to discriminate, quote-unquote? Why, in your opinion, from a legal perspective, have we seen that kind of a reaction?
Well, that is a good question. I think the concern here is why is it, who is in bringing this up? These state religious freedom restoration acts have been passed for, you know, almost 20 years, more than 20 years. Why is Indiana suddenly jumping into the game? And it's not coincidental that it's on the heels of a recognition of same-sex marriage. And the opponents of this see this as a way to erode into the increasing recognition of rights for same-sex couples and to evade, you know, to prevent them from being safe from discrimination. That's what they're worried about. I think they're exaggerating the likelihood. The reality is these RFRAs, we've had them for decades. People have tried to invoke them to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. There has not been one successful invocation of the of a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So I think it's a very small risk. But I think some people say, why raise the risk at all?
David, the governor this morning had a press conference to talk about what he thinks needs to be done. We have a clip from that. I'd like to listen to that clip and then ask you a question about that.
Let me say I believe this is a clarification, but it's also a fix. It's a fix of a bill that, through mischaracterization and confusion, has come to be greatly misunderstood. And I'm determined to address this week and to move forward as a state.
The governor was responding to this intense criticism we were just talking about of the bill. Usually these kinds of things get worked out in the courts. How can you square those two situations? You know, is it possible to, quote unquote, fix this bill now?
Well, there's two things. If the concern is it could be used to discriminate, and here's why I don't think it can be used to discriminate. What this law says is the government, if it tries to interfere with your religious beliefs, you can come in and say, this is unfair, you're infringing on my religious expression, which is important. We have a First Amendment after all. And then the government can come back and say, yes, we are. But we have a very good reason. Mm-hmm. And the courts have been clear, even with these statutes, the statutes say if the government has a what they call a compelling interest, but there's an important reason. And court after court has said preventing discrimination is a compelling government interest. So that's why, you know, the 16 law professors supported has said these fears are exaggerated. Now you can put that in the statute. You can say, okay, rather than wait for a court to say preventing discrimination is a compelling interest, we're going to put it in the statute. And so if the government has a compelling interest and an example of compelling interest is preventing discrimination against people on the basis of their religion, their sexual orientation, their race, et cetera, then just put it in the bill and you don't have to wait for a court to say it.
There's one other clip from the governor that I want to get to. It talks about protection in Indiana's non-discrimination statute and possibly adding language that protects LGBT folks. So let's listen to that.
But let me say with great respect, I think that's a separate issue. All right? It's not my position. I'm not advocating for it. I understand some people are. But that's a separate question that ought to be considered separate from this idea of religious liberty.
David, do you agree with that?
Well, it depends what question you're asking. If the question is, you know, how can we protect people's religious liberties without infringing on others? That is a different question. But if the real question, this debate is not about that. This debate is about protecting people from discrimination on the basis of their sexual orientation. And the reality is that's where the action is on the anti-discrimination provisions. The reality is whether or not you have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act has a tiny effect on whether you're protected from discrimination. Because this RFRA only matters if you don't have an anti-discrimination provision. You're free to discriminate. You don't need a RFRA, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You're already free to discriminate. And if there is a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, then, as I said, the government's compelling interest in preventing discrimination overrides religious freedom rights. So what's really key is whether you have an anti-discrimination law. So the reality is if you live in Indianapolis, you have that protection. If you live in Westfield, you don't have that protection. And that you can go state by state. Only about 20 states have a statewide laws. And so if you live in California or if you live in New York or Massachusetts or Illinois, you have that protection. But if you live in Texas, you live in Florida, you live in Ohio, you're in the same boat as Hoosiers. You have to hope your city and many cities do.
Right.
So if your city, if you live in Philadelphia, you're okay, but if you're in rural Pennsylvania, you're not okay. Same as in Indiana. If you're in Indianapolis or Fort Wayne or South Bend or Evansville or Bloomington or Lafayette, you've got protection, whether or not there's a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And if you live in Noblesville or Fishers or Tell City, you don't have protection. And whether and repealing this repealing the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is not going to change that. So there are two different questions, and which question you're asking makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I think that's what adds to the complexity, because those kinds of things get overlooked when the conversation gets heated. David, thank you for that. We're going to be back in after the break with Bob Schultz and Tom Lobianco, and we'll ask David some more questions. So I think we're off to a good start. We'll take your calls, so call in and check us out on Facebook, and we'll be back shortly. Welcome back. I'm John Ketzenberger in on No Limits for John Kroll, who will be back later this week. We've been talking about the Indiana RFRA bill, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed and signed into law last week and has been the subject of controversy ever since. We've been talking with David Orentlicker. I wanted to ask one more thing, David. You're a professor of constitutional law and a former legislator. You know, we've heard the governor and proponents of the bill say many times that this bill is the same as one that was passed before, and we established earlier that that's not necessarily the case. There are some differences. But one of the interesting questions is, you know, you hear the assertion, well, this is the same bill that Bill Clinton as president signed in 1993 or then State Senator Barack Obama signed in Illinois in 2000. I can't remember when it was.
1998.
Okay. Yeah. But as we were talking before the break, those are anti-discrimination. In his state, there's an anti-discrimination law that makes a big difference in how the effect of the RFRA works, correct?
Yes. Having the anti-discrimination law, well, it's complicated because if you don't have an anti-discrimination law, then RFRA is irrelevant because you're free to discriminate because there's no anti-discrimination law. So passing a RFRA doesn't change it. If you have an anti-discrimination law, then the question is, does your ability, your religious freedom override your duty not to discriminate? And so far the courts have said it doesn't override. So in some sense, they're really different issues. In terms of the religious freedom question, the biggest reason why President Clinton's signing or Barack Obama's voting in Illinois are different is the expansion of the protections to corporations. That what the real fear was government denying you your religious rights, not trying to get in between businesses and their consumers. That was not envisioned when President Clinton signed, and when there was this overwhelming support in Congress, it wasn't envisioned when Barack Obama voted for it. I think that's what's changed, and that is a key difference. Now, whether that's a major threat, we can talk about, but I think that's the fair claim that they make to say, I didn't expect the Supreme Court to issue a Hobby Lobby decision.
So, Bob, we've heard from the corporate community in Indianapolis. We've heard from a lot of folks around the country, corporations, private individuals, and that kind of thing. As the person who helps market and helps shape the perception of Indianapolis and to a slightly lesser extent Indiana, what has all of this controversy around the bill meant from your perspective?
Well, I'll be very honest, and thank you for having me on, John, today. This is catastrophic, and I don't mean to be overdramatic. I really want to echo the words of our mayor yesterday. 40 years of hard work. Indiana has always had to work harder than most other cities and states, here in Indianapolis too, to communicate a brand of hospitality. We heard it loud and clear at the Super Bowl. It's just a nice place. And to have that reputation being raked across the front headlines of every major news source in the nation is damning to the progress that this city has made. And I'm not a legislator, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a lobbyist, but I am a civic promoter. And it is devastating. There is irreparable harm that has been caused in the last few days. I do not think the state legislature gets it. I think some of them understand the impact, but are just now starting to understand that impact. And where is this discussion and the unintended consequences in that discussion prior to the passing of this?
Well, so we've heard today from the governor. We heard yesterday from the mayor saying that there needs to be changes. The city county council passed a resolution that supports changes to the law. Many of them we talked about earlier with David Orentlicker. What do you think needs to be done to help ameliorate some of the problems that have already occurred?
Well, I think this type of dialogue is incredibly helpful. I believe that the conversations are taking place both inside and outside of chamber right now for a fix to this. I think David's comments are very intelligent and certainly communicate an understanding of the broader dimension here. The reality is that this is a perception issue. And one of the thoughts is that, you know, leaders in the state house need to recognize the importance of backing off when the perception is so strong. And perhaps if they can't fix it now, repeal it, send it to a study committee of some sort and discuss it further, and don't let this play out any further. There is, you know, in my business, which is public relations, marketing, and communications, perception is reality. And you have to address perception and anger and fear and concern before you can give an intelligent response, because people, anger and emotion make people deaf. And unfortunately, there are a lot of deaf people across the nation right now. And also, we have still a strong reputation of hospitality, and that needs to be reinforced, especially this week.
You raise a great point, Bob, and I'm going to bring in Tom Lobianco here. Tom is joining us on the telephone. Tom, are you with us?
Uh-huh. Thanks, John.
Tom's with the Indianapolis Star, a political analyst, and I wanted to dive into that perception is reality question a little bit. You were at the governor's press conference this morning, and you've seen what's gone before. How strong in your perception, in your view, is that perception, and is it possible to redirect that perception at this point?
Well, it certainly looks like the perception is set. You know, what's funny about this is when Pence had this presser today, what it kind of reminded me of was when Richard Murdoch was in the aftermath of his comments from the 2012 U.S. Senate debate, where he said that babies conceived in rape are still something, quote, something God intended. And after that, he went out and he apologized. But he didn't apologize for the actual thought. He apologized for people not understanding what he meant. And that's kind of what's been happening here. When you look inside the State House, and when you look at what happened with the governor's press conference earlier, they're not saying, okay, look, we got it wrong, we're going to go and change the statute. If anything, it sounds like they're going to change the preamble, sort of this legislative intent, which is, you know, theoretically then used by the courts, not as much as the statute itself, of course. But what they're trying to do is go back and say, look, you guys got us wrong. This doesn't allow discrimination. All your legal analyses that are out there, you don't get it. And as part of this, and this is what Pence has been doing, it's blaming the national media. He made that distinction today that he's not blaming the local media, but blaming the media at large. So the politics of it is, they're not changing it, but they're saying that, hey, all you guys got this wrong. Everyone else has this wrong. And that's what they're digging in on this.
Hey, Tom, I want to play a clip from Mayor Ballard yesterday at a press conference, and then we'll get back to a question to you about that.
Mm-hmm. 40 years of history as one of the most hospitable communities in America should not be placed in jeopardy with this act. This isn't about politics. This is not about PR. This is about doing what's right for individuals, for our city, and for our state. Discrimination is wrong, and I hope that message is being heard loud and clear at our State House.
So, Tom, you have some pretty divergent views there from the mayor and the governor, yet they're of the same political party and see many other issues the same way. Can this be reconciled in your mind from a political perspective, or is there a split among the Republicans on this?
We all know that there's a major split inside the party. For Hoosiers, Red, you could colloquially refer to this as the split between the Mitch Daniels and the Mike Pence wings of the party, right? The Daniels / business-type conservatives, and now the more social and religious conservatives that Mike Pence represents. And these are the wedge issues that come in that really split it apart. You know, what's fascinating to me about this is that this isn't just human rights campaign and like national gay rights groups coming in and saying that this law is discriminatory. This is Angie's List. This is Greg Ballard. This is Apple CEO Tim Cook. All of these people, with their own ability to make this determination, are saying it's discriminatory. And what's funny is that that argument's being has been made and is nationally now, and only now are the supporters of this kind of playing catch up and trying to really go back and try to relitigate it. And I think that's where this perception problem has come from, because the perception is set at this point. I mean, my God, we've been mocked on Saturday Night Live, multiple times now. So I think that once you've made it into the onion, all right, that's the perception is set.
Tom, thanks. I'm going to go to Beth in Indianapolis. She's on the telephone here. Hang on just a moment. Beth, do we have you?
Yes, you do, John. Thanks so very much. I'm very interested in this debate. We had a legislators' breakfast here in Hendricks County on Monday morning at 7 a.m. And when, I was taken aback by Governor Pence's performance on national TV. But nevertheless, I'll make my question very short. With regard to the statute as it currently is, I understand, I believe, after having read the 16 professors' opinion about, why you should have RFRA, there is several paragraphs there that indicate that there is a possibility that it could come up as, a potential lawsuit for discrimination. And in 1993 and before, the five covered areas are race, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, and disabilities. And we have that as individual rights on the federal level. Now, my question is this. If you leave it like it were and don't change it, or if only perhaps now, as I just heard this gentleman speak in a preamble, does that leave the possibility that I understand that the lawsuits could still come forward? Would the professor speak to first dollar of defense? Because that's very expensive for a business owner, and you would think that they wouldn't want to have that kind of situation going on. And number two, could it be possible that the fix that they are all speaking about that they want to make would be pushed down to the local level? And this is what I'm very, very, very scared of, because I do not want to have this discussion one-on-one with my local township government, with my local town council. I don't want to be the person, that, for example, as he mentioned in Bartholomew County,
okay,
or if I were
Beth,
sitting out.
Beth, I think we've got the gist of your question. I'm going to let Professor Orentlicker answer that. Thank you.
Let me say the simple answer, what is the best fix for all of this, which is, I think, part of your question. The best fix for all of this is, you alluded to these protected statuses. We have a federal Civil Rights Act dating to 1964, and the simplest thing to do would be to amend that to include sexual orientation. So this is a problem in Indiana. It's a problem in 30 other states. So let's fix it on a national level and say you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. And then the next fix is for these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts to say that preventing discrimination is a compelling government interest. So you make sure that all the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts say that. You do those two things, and I think you've really made a difference. If you just get rid of our Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you've done very little. If your goal is to protect people from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Getting rid of religious freedom restoration acts will do very little for that. What you really need to advance the interests of equality is to pass anti-discrimination laws. And we can do it in Indiana, but there are 30 other states that need them too.
And in Indiana, we're talking about a law that really doesn't take effect until July 1st, correct? So it can't really be challenged until that point.
That's correct.
So we're making challenges to something that's still not in effect. But then the legislature's talking about changes, Tom, to the law. That will be kind of an interesting process, given that the Final Four is in town, and a lot of the rooms that legislators stay in are booked by people coming up from Kentucky and down from East Lansing. Is the legislature going to be able to handle any of this week, Tom?
Well, that is the question, right? You know, something has to be done by Thursday because they can't really stay here through Friday. And right now, what we've been hearing the most kind of behind the scenes is that there might be some sort of legislative intent preamble added to the statute that says, you know, hey, look, this is not about discrimination. You know, you can't use this to deny services to gay couples. That's what sounds like probably will happen. We do know what is off the table based on what Pence has said, based on what Senate President Pro Tem David Long has said. And that is, we're not going to have the protected class for LGBT. That will not happen. And there will not be, at least as they've said now, there will not be a repeal of this law. So it sounds like a repeal and study is highly unlikely. That could change. But right now it sounds like we're going to have a preamble kind of explaining what the law is meant to do, but no real changes in the law itself.
Hmm. So we have a tweet from Jill, and she asks a question I think is interesting. You mentioned Governor Daniels earlier. What has Governor Daniels said in all this, and could this have a big effect on industry, on universities?
Sure. Well, Daniels himself has been quiet. You know, we recall that he kind of took this vow of political celibacy after you know, his board appointees selected him president of the university. So since then, he's really tried to stay out of most political discussions. The university itself has come out and said, look, we support diversity. But Daniels has been quiet, and the more that people weigh in, the louder that silence becomes.
Does it matter from your perspective that he's silent?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, at this point, it's everyone has really weighed in on this. I mean, it's a national discussion, and he wants to be and he is a national leader in higher education discussions. He goes before Congress routinely. So now the question is, okay, you come out, and this is something all politicians do. This is not a knock on him specifically, but you come out when everything's fine and everything sounds good, but then you go and hide when things are too hot. So that's what's happening right here.
Bob, as we go into the next break, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, the way the focus has been away from one of the biggest events on Indy's calendars ever, and that is the Final Four. From your perspective, you know, is there a way to direct it back to the Final Four so that we can get to the you know, positive matter here, or is that completely overshadowed by all of these things?
Well, we'd like to think that it is not overshadowed. It is the most incredible event that has built our reputation here as a city of hospitality and welcoming, and that is using sports as a strategy to welcome guests and the dollars they leave behind. The economic impact of these types of activities are immense, but more importantly, we as a community need to hold true to our commitment to the NCAA and to the fans, and most importantly, to the student athletes who are here to compete on the biggest stage of their life, and that it's about them. And so, you know, as they come and arrive into town, I do hope there is a little bit of a moratorium on the angst. We are very proud about Indy Welcomes All. That is a hashtag and a strategy we're using. There are rights that are here, and we're going to celebrate that, and that Indy does welcome all, especially the NCAA.
Well, thank you, Bob. When we come back from the break, we'll take calls and read some tweets and some Facebook comments. So come back after the break to No Limits. Hi, I'm John Ketzenberger. I'm filling in for John Krall on No Limits today. We're talking about House Enrolled Act 101, which is commonly known as the Restoration of Freedom, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. And earlier today, Governor Pence had a press conference, and yesterday the legislative leaders had a press conference to discuss the situation, and many people thought that it was about the possibility of changes to the law or make amendments. I understand that at this hour, the legislative leaders are talking about that again. But Tom, are you surprised that there hasn't been a formal plan of action already implemented?
Yeah, this really speaks to this kind of split inside the party, like you mentioned before. These are things that have to be run through the caucus. And, for your listeners who aren't familiar with the inner workings with the state house, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans really make a lot of these key decisions in private in caucuses. And this is routine. The Democrats do this as well. But what has to happen is any sort of decision needs to get vetted by them in order to have any sort of support to happen. And as of yesterday, at the end of the day yesterday, it seemed like they couldn't agree on exactly how to do this. The problem is it's really hard to come up with a compromise. All right, if you don't want to add a protected class of LGBT and you don't want to repeal the law, it's uncertain exactly what you can do. This isn't like a tax bill where you can sort of change the rates or add some money somewhere.
Right.
It's a lot harder to find compromise on this, and that's the problem. And they really didn't. By Pence not coming out today with a clear answer, the reaction I've heard from a lot of observers around here has been he made it worse. He fixed the problem with George Stephanopoulos from the weekend, but by really not having a clear answer today, he's only pouring fuel on the fire.
Tom, we're going to go to a call from Adam in Indianapolis.
Yes.
Adam, please ask your question.
Thank you much. Thank you very much, John. My question was, it seemed like the governor was setting himself and RFRA up to be victims in his press conference today, and I wondered if the gentleman from the Star or you had any thoughts on the fact that this was signed in a private ceremony that looked like the photos that we all see on Facebook may have just been leaked and not officially issued by the governor's office with certain attendees raising questions, and that the governor's office wouldn't issue a list of attendees for the private signing if that hasn't been a driving force behind a lot of the objections raised to RFRA now.
Okay, Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom, what
sure.
do you think?
This tactic of blaming the media has been something that they've relied on routinely throughout this, and the governor continued that again today. It's hard to say. I mean, some of this has been overblown. Absolutely. The actual effect and, kind of going back to what a lot of people have been saying about the perception problem, it is. I mean, the reality of it might not be a major impact. Part of the problem here is that it needs to be tested in court in order for people to really understand what will actually happen. But the actual impact might be marginal, but the perception has been terrible. And the counterfight here, and this is sort of a national playbook. I mean, a lot of this is national talking points at this point, too. And the national fight really is, okay, blame the media, blame people who are, quote, misconstruing, stretching, twisting, blame the media for this. That's really the focus, regardless of what's actually being said.
Bob, we were talking, and I think Tom raised an interesting point. A lot of the momentum for this has come from outside the state. There is an awful lot of national impetus for the public relations battle that's going on right now. Here in Indianapolis, as somebody who knows all these players, has dealt with them before, has spent a lot of time trying to work building up Indianapolis, Do you feel a little helpless about the fact that all of this is going on and you really have very little influence on it?
Well, we like to think that we have a lot of influence on it, specifically with a coalition that we're forming. And this coalition is made up of academics, of corporate lobbyists, as certainly corporations, including Salesforce, including Cummins, including Angie's List and Lilly, and the civic organizations, the Sports Corp, the Visit Indy, all coming together with the chamber. And those lobbyists have those relationships. These civic leaders have the long-term interests of our state well beyond, and I'm not suggesting that the colloquialism and the of an individual legislator's term is at stake here, but we know that this has sustained years and years of effort. So we believe that there has to be a coordinated approach, a coordinated response. Members of this coalition have met with legislative leaders. We'll continue to have that conversation. And the mayor is at the helm here. It doesn't have to be a citywide and an Indianapolis-only coalition. We think that it belongs statewide, and it will continue to grow. So this is where the action is right now, because the impact is real. The number of first convention officially canceled.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly have many, many, many that have indicated an interest and a desire to see what happens, that they'll pull back. And we're talking significant dollars, not only to the hospitality industry. This is to the state of Indiana with taxes and all. And so I just did a quick call to some of our attraction partners, from the Motor Speedway to the Children's Museum to the zoo, calls left and right saying, I don't think I can come visit you anymore. And that's what happens here, is there's no clear leader saying, where are we going with this? How do we address that perception issue, and how do we make a repair?
So it must be frustrating when you hear the governor say that they aren't going to make, the law is going to remain in place and they'll try to fix it, quote unquote, but that he's working the phones. But I imagine from your perspective, if this had not happened, that would not be an issue. We'd be talking about Duke and Michigan State.
And that's what we should be talking about. And we need to be talking about them. But we certainly need to do that in the context of what others are coming to. And so they're going to arrive in our airport and they're going to see a very strong statement. Indy welcomes all. We have to differentiate right now what the reality is as of being a very hospitable and welcoming city to the issues that are affecting our at the State House. And so we have concerns about how we're going to play that out, but we have a strategy in place, and that's what we're going to do, is honor that commitment to the NCAA.
When did this coalition come together, Bob?
Within the last few days.
So
people started gathering. It certainly was discussed. It's something that needs to have a coordinated response. And this is the important time. I mean, this is a very critical time. But as was shared already, you know, we have in Indianapolis a human rights ordinance. The state does not have that. And so there are other cities across the state of Indiana that have some level of an HRO. And we wanted to include them in this process and say, let's talk about a solution here.
So the way Indianapolis has operated in the past has been very collaborative. There has been a lot of buy-in from people across the community. And it sounds like that's the result or the effort that's being made now. But you haven't faced a challenge like this before, too. I mean, you've had to move mountains, quote-unquote, to make this an economically vibrant place, but now you're dealing with a very different set of circumstances. How daunting is that?
Well, it's interesting. Someone used the perception that this is our hurricane or this is our terrorist attack, but no one's feeling sorry for us. And so what we're starting to see is a little bit of coming around, especially with Indianapolis, that people see this as a city that is trying to fight the fight with them. And that's whether that is an intended consequence or otherwise, whether it's Salesforce or otherwise, who are taking a very verbal approach now of supporting Indianapolis, of not boycotting Indianapolis, and how do we get that momentum shifted to rely a little bit on the goodwill that has been established because of the welcoming atmosphere that's present.
Well, and that's an interesting question. I'm going to go to Tom in just a second, but first I want to start with you, Bob. The effect of social media as a megaphone in all of this, and for the rapid dissemination of points of view that then go viral, you are trying to address that with similar mechanisms, right?
So we're starting to – certainly, obviously, the social is strong. The hashtag Boycott Indiana is of great concern. Our friends at Radius, who monitor this type of activity, did a case in point time look at social impact just from the signing of that bill on the governor's desk through Saturday. 700 million media impressions around hashtag Boycott Indiana alone. That's not just about people upset here in Indianapolis.
Wow.
700 million, and we need to turn that tide, and the legislature needs to say that it is their responsibility to do so.
Now, Tom, the same goes for the way the news has been disseminated, and as you said earlier, the governor has taken to task some of the media for its reporting about the story, but it has moved rapidly, and it has moved across the globe in a big hurry. Have you seen anything like this before, and how do you think that's been addressed by the people who are participating, both on the media side and from the state side?
Well, it's kind of reminiscent. The way they've been handling it is kind of reminiscent of the state-run news service they tried to start that just in. As Bob pointed out, on a massive scale, some folks kind of point out some corollaries between this and the right to work fight of 2012 and the Super Bowl being in town. I mean, you have all this major focus on Indianapolis. But I think the difference here, and this is why you have this incredible number, like 700 million impressions, which is just massive for something coming out of Indy. It's because it's a guttural issue. It's very these hot-button issues, they really – everyone has an opinion on it. And it's not something esoteric. This isn't labor law. The actual legality, legal part of it is incredibly esoteric. Question of, will gay couples be refused service by a florist? Same question that George Stephanopoulos asked over and over again. That's guttural. That hits people. And this just took off. I've never seen anything like it since I've been here. And never saw anything like it in Maryland. It's been incredible.
Was it fair for the question to be yes or no, does this law discriminate? And if it was fair, how was the response?
Well, yeah, absolutely it's fair, because that was the question that was never answered before. Does it allow for discrimination? It's been answered now. But in a way, almost too late. The parts of it, the way this was argued beforehand, and I think what you see is that there was not a major public push on this before it got signed. What's funny is how the debate is almost happening after mm-hmm. the debate would happen under normal circumstances. And I think that if this national attention had come while this measure was being debated in the legislature, I'm not sure it ever would have passed the House or Senate, frankly, because of this incredible amount of pressure that's out there.
David, you've been in those caucuses. You understand how that works. The fact is, there are 71 Republicans in the House and 40 Republicans in the Senate, so they have a supermajority. What Tom is saying seems to make sense. Does it to you?
Yeah, this is one of the downsides of having a supermajority. You begin to believe, as my wife says, your press releases too much, and you don't have a good perspective. And as Tom said, it would have been much better if they had gotten this reality check before they passed the bill. There was testimony against it, but it just wasn't at the right level, and they, unfortunately, they're not getting it yet, and
right.
It's time to cut your losses and move on.
But if they don't see them as losses, they won't be cut, and will remain in the same situation. Bob, is that your worst nightmare?
Our worst nightmare is people stop coming.
Yeah.
And so this isn't only about those who want to cancel. This is about the lost business revenue that we'll never see, because they're just going to overlook Indianapolis now in a consideration for a future convention or an expansion. And this isn't also just about tourism. This is about companies who could locate or relocate or expand here. This is about attracting the next CEO that would eventually lead and spin off a great high-tech company that we could claim here in Indianapolis, but no longer is considering a visit to and relocation to here. So this is hitting in everything from attractions to big business to small business to opportunity to what we have built our brand around, which is Eds, Meds, and Beds, and how can we attract more of that?
Well, and so that brings us to the last question, I think, and that is the political fallout potential for this, because as we've mentioned, it's primarily a Republican legislature. The governor is a Republican, and I'm curious that this hasn't reduced the half-life, if you will, of the supermajority, and how voters will react to this. Tom, I'll give you first crack at that.
Sure. Well, the fallout has absolutely been the worst for Pence. There's no doubt about that. His handling of this has been really bad. It's reflective of what happened with the Justin News Service, but on a much grander scale. It's the worst for him. I'm not sure how much this really plays out, though, in the state house races, though. One of the things I've noticed when I've done gone out and talked with voters in previous elections is that they don't always look at the name further down the ballot. This is a top-of-the-ticket problem. This is something that people will remember in 2016, although I'm not sure how much it plays out in House or Senate races.
David, what do you think about the potential fallout? A lot of what goes on in the caucuses is based on trust. I'm guessing that some of the political fallout will be internal with legislators who feel like they didn't get the full picture before they voted, and now they may have regrets about that.
Yeah, this is a kind of issue that can split a caucus, and the long if the the bigger the damage, the more impact this is going to have. And you know, we're in 2015, so we won't know until 2016 whether this is something that people start to forget, or it really does. If it has lasting damage, then people won't forget, and legislators will have a lot of explaining to do.
Well, we'll see if they carry that message forward, Bob. But I'm going to give you the last word here, Bob, about the situation. We've talked about how dire it is. We've talked about the reasons for it and the basis for the law and the problems that people have perceived about that. Looking at it as positively as you can, how do you see things going forward for Indianapolis and Indiana?
Well, I'd like to say that this will put a little bit of a boost, or actually hopefully a big boost, behind our collective civic energy that is here in our central Indiana and throughout our state, that we want to work hard. We work harder than most to attract others to our state, and we have to continue that fight, and let's bring more people to our city and state.
Bob, thank you very much. I'm John Ketzenberger. I've been a guest host for John Crawl on No Limits. I want to thank our guests today, David Orentlicker, Bob Schultz, and Tom LoBianco. Tune in again Thursday for No Limits. And thank you for listening today.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.